This episode is brought to you by Baby Bee, Australian-owned and designed prams combining quality, safety and style.
When we did announce it to social media, we tried to announce it in a way that was going to be mindful of those that were struggling or that would find it triggering, because I think when we went through the miscarriage, it was actually one of the ladies in the sort of health system that said to me, everyone you know will be pregnant now. She goes, now that you've had a loss, you will just think the whole world is pregnant and falling pregnant around you.
And exactly what happened.
It is.
Welcome to Parenthood, where each week we explore the lives of Aussie mums and dads and what's really going on behind closed doors. I'm your host, Leonia Kidinor, mum of two, business owner and relationship coach. Let's begin.
Welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast and our first episode for the season and for 2024. I hope you've had a great break. Mine was really good, and I'm really looking forward to diving deep into all of the happenings on my end during our next episode, which is a real talk with my bestie Liv. So stay tuned for that one. For now, I'm so excited to bring you this episode. It's so vulnerable and gripping. It's with our beautiful guests, Geelong football player Gary Rowan and his beautiful wife Maddie. Let's get into the episode. Gaz, Maddie, welcome to the podcast. It's thank so good to have you with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. No, thank you.
Really appreciate you guys making the drive down as well and fresh from Hawaii.
Yes.
I was just admiring your tan. Fresh, I love that, like, I'm like a mixed race human being and I'm like, oh my God, your tan's amazing.
Yeah, you look mine's like looking good too.
Oh, yours.
Yeah. I can't leave him out.
Yeah. How was the trip? Was it amazing?
It was. It was so good. It was beautiful. Yeah. Weather's beautiful. The city's beautiful.
Yeah.
It was just nice to get away. Oh. So we heard the weather here hasn't been that good.
No.
So it was a good time to jump on a plane, I think.
Absolutely. Had you been to Hawaii before?
Yeah, we both have.
Second time.
Yeah, no, yeah, such a good, like, that's on my list. Funnily enough, I've never been, but as in not funnily enough, but, you know, it is such a common destination for a lot of people, I've just never made the trip. But it is the one flight, isn't it?
It
there?
Is.
Yeah.
Well, I think you can. There's some airlines that stop off. You can do like Fiji Airways and stop off in Fiji.
Yeah.
Take your fancy on the way to Hawaii. Or you can do direct. So, the 10 hours is not amazing.
Yeah.
10 hours straight, but you do it. These things you do.
Yeah. Then you get there and you get, you know, the lay put on you and it's all happening.
Yeah.
It's not too hot, which is good. It's like, majority 30, so it's good for a redhead to go at that time of year.
Yeah,
so
he was happy.
I was in the sun for a little bit and then in the shade. So
like white really with good. Sunscreen on your face.
Exactly. Love zinc everywhere.
Something I could not relate to at all. So for those listening, I'm joined with by Gaz and Maddie. So Gary is a Geelong Cats premiership player, dad of three with one on the way and about to commence his 15th AFL season. That is no easy feat, mate. Like, kudos to you.
Yeah, still going. Don't know how.
No.
A bit older these days, but no, I'm still feel like I'm still can hack it.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And Maddie is a physiotherapist living on the Bellarine Peninsula, peninsula with her husband. So, and how are you feeling? How many weeks are we now, pregnancy wise?
What are we? 22 today. Mm. Actually,
okay.
So feeling much better now. It was a bit of a rough ride early on, with hyperemesis. But I'm vertical. I'm happy, and we're cruising along now, which is really exciting.
Yeah, massively. And I want to delve into that a bit more because I know a lot of listeners probably, you know, have experienced it or who have friends who have experienced it, and it's just sounds like a little bit of a nasty bugger. But I guess I'd love to know a little bit more about your journey. So did you guys always know that you wanted to have children? Even just growing up, did you always know you wanted to be parents?
Obviously, I love kids. I'm one of five, so I've got a big family and nieces and nephews and stuff. So I love kids and, I've always wanted to, have my own family.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think we'll touch on this as well. Went through a period when I was a bit younger, not being 100% sure if I wanted to have a family just with the diagnosis of my mum with Huntington's disease and whether or not I would potentially have that to consider in my future. But when I was lucky enough to find out that I didn't have that disease, that then became, a very big consideration in my life, something I hadn't really thought of at a sort of younger age. And then, Gaz comes along and all of a sudden, we want to have kids together. Yeah. So,
at what age did you find out that you didn't have the disease?
I think I was about 23 when I went through the testing. Wow.
So obviously it's a genetic thing.
It is genetic. Wow. So it's 50% chance of inheriting it if you have a parent that has the gene.
Wow.
It's literally just 50-50. There's no if, buts, or maybes about it. So,
do you have siblings that?
No. Okay. So I was the only child to my mum.
Okay.
So my mum was obviously the positive parent.
Yeah.
So I have two brothers, but they're from my dad and my stepmom. So I was the only one, that could have potentially had it, but I'm very lucky that I came away without it and could consider having a family.
Can you tell us a little bit about your mum's story? Because I know that when you were 19, she passed away, and I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, but thank you.
At what point did she get quite sick? Like, what happened?
So her father had the disease. Her dad wasn't in her life a lot. She knew that he had the disease. So she knew that it was a possibility for her as well. So she was probably about 30 when she first thought she might have noticed some symptoms that were really, really mild. So typically Huntington's disease presents really early on, like Parkinson's. So you have a lot of those uncontrolled, rigid sort of movements, like constantly tapping the foot or tapping the fingers and just little things that she started to see coming on probably from about 30 and then formally got diagnosed at 40. So, it had progressed quite a bit throughout those 10 years. And when she was formally diagnosed, I think I was maybe in year 8. So I was probably about 13 at the time. And then, so she passed away at 47 years old.
Oh, just, it's so, actually get goosebumps hearing that.
Brutal. I'm not sure if it's actually proven, but I think it affects women quicker and more severe, whereas men sort of have a longer lifespan and it progresses a bit more slowly throughout a male's life.
Okay.
So, from her diagnosis to her passing away was about 7 years.
So you grew up essentially caring for her to some extent?
So when she was formally diagnosed at 40, it had sort of progressed. It was quite severe body movements at that time, and it's all involuntary. And then it gets quite psychological as well. So she lost a lot of just rationality. Like, she couldn't sort of understand how to pay bills anymore. She couldn't make those kinds of decisions. Even just going to the supermarket, like, she would make just really irrational decisions. She'd see that washing powder was on special, so she'd buy like a whole trolley's worth of washing powder. So it just takes a lot of that independence away from you, both physically and sort of psychologically as well. So I was obviously growing up, becoming a teenager, going through high school, but needing to be the one to pay bills, needing to be the one to, organize the groceries and just things like that, while I was also trying to navigate, growing up and being who I was. So it was really challenging. But we tried to keep Mum at home and keep her normal life as much as possible. But she did actually move into a care facility. I think she was about 44 or 45 at the time. So she had about 2 or 3 years in a care facility, which was sort of like an aged care home, I guess, but it was specific to Huntington's disease. So she got to a point she couldn't shower, she couldn't walk unassisted, she couldn't feed herself. She was nonverbal by the time that she'd passed away. So she'd just lost all sort of motor control and function by that time. Passed away.
So incredibly sad. And I just think from you would be such a wise kind of owl in a way. Unfortunately,
I get told that a lot.
Right? To go through that. When you reflect on that journey, does it sort of impact the way in which you hope
to parent, do you think you'll be more overprotective because you don't want your kid to jump in and have do everything, or do you think that you'll be the opposite? Have you thought about it?
I have thought about it, and to be honest, I don't really know how it's going to come across. Yeah. I think I'm obviously quite resilient, and you know, I think that that will probably come across in my parenting and in the hard times, but I do wonder how it's going to shape me as a mum. My mum was, she was just the most sympathetic, you know, most beautiful emotional person. And I think having gone through some of the experiences that I have with her, I've probably shut off a lot of my emotion at times when I didn't know how to deal with these things, especially at, you know, a young age and being a teenager and not really understanding how to express these feelings or how to grieve and how to do all of those things as well. So I think I'm definitely aware of the mum that she was and how amazing she was, and I just want to replicate that. I'd love to mirror that. But I am probably a little bit protective as well of not wanting to put a child through what I went through, I guess, and that was a big contributor into me thinking about having a family when I wasn't sure whether I had the disease or not, because it probably wasn't something that I wanted to put a child through myself. So, now that that's all out of the equation, I don't need to think about that. It sort of opened up these big wide doors that I didn't ever know whether were going to be a reality for me. Yeah. So, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be,
It's always a journey for all of us, right? But it's just, it's amazing. I always love to reflect. Even now, I've got a 4 and 3 year old, and just like on when you have children, your childhood and all that shit from back in the day kind of bubbles up to the surface. And you're like, oh, here it is. There's the inner child, right? It's always interesting reflecting and going, oh yeah, I probably did that because of that or whatever. But hindsight is something that's
exactly
quite
like I can look at it all now and say, this is how I want to parent. This is what I want to do. But who knows if that's going to actually happen or not. I just hope some of my positive traits can come out in the baby and in our parenting, and I'm sure mum will come through as well, and there'll be elements of her throughout it all.
Absolutely. How was like your conceiving journey? Were you fortunate to fall pregnant quite quickly, or did it take a bit of time, or what did that look like?
We were fortunate to fall pregnant quickly. However, we had a miscarriage with our first pregnancy. So it was a missed miscarriage, which we found out at the dating scan. So we were about 7 weeks, that the baby had no heartbeat, but I had kept growing the pregnancy. So my body hadn't registered that we'd lost the baby. So I was still growing. I was still pregnant. I was still showing symptoms and everything. All of my HCG levels were elevating and everything was still going ahead as though we had a viable pregnancy. But unfortunately, at our first scan, we got told there was no heartbeat for the baby. So that was obviously quite a challenging time. We were told to sort of hang in there and hold hope for a follow-up scan that was 2 weeks later, just in case our dates were wrong, or just in case, you know, there was something that would continue to develop and we might have possibly just been scanning a bit too early at the time to hear anything or to see as much as we wanted to see. But 2 weeks later, we had that confirmation that there was definitely no heartbeat. There was no changes at that point. And they could confirm at the time that we had officially lost the pregnancy. And I had to have a D&C surgery to remove that pregnancy because my body wasn't miscarrying and wasn't registering that we'd lost it. So that was, although we conceived, quite easily and quickly, that was a big hiccup that we didn't see coming.
Absolutely. Were you both in the room at the time at the birth scan?
Yep.
What was that like for you guys? Like,
So obviously I lost the child, my last partner, so brought back a lot of memories. I'd go into these scans not hoping much. I just want to make sure every scan is ticked off along the way. I just went in, hopefully first box is ticked. Mm. Unfortunately, it wasn't. But yeah, we had time to grieve by ourselves and together, and time to we had went again.
Yeah, and for context for those listening, you had a child, and then was it shortly after the birth the child passed?
Yeah, so she had anencephaly. That's when part of the skull doesn't fully mold together.
Okay.
So leading up, we knew that she wasn't going to have life after birth. Could be a second. She could have been passed away, but when she came out, I just don't know how long. Mm. So leading up to it, we knew it was going to happen. But yeah, same like going into this is making sure every box is ticked and the baby was going well. And it was a pretty tough time.
I think Gaz really made sure when we did find out that we were pregnant, he sort of stayed quite reserved and knew that, you know, there's a lot that could happen between a positive pregnancy test and, you know, the first scan or, you know, ticking those boxes, as you said. So I think, he was quite mindful not to get, I guess, too excited because he's definitely lived those experiences where it can not be so straightforward and not potentially be good news. So,
bit more guarded, I guess, and
very,
just taking it step by step. With that, was it a disease or so? Or with Willow, what was it?
Yeah, it's like a tube defect or something.
Okay.
Like so they actually don't know why it happened. Yeah. So like it's still studies and stuff. So they're still figuring that out. But we had twins, so identical twins. So whatever we did to one was going to affect Bella, the other one. So, we went along with it all and, obviously we knew it was going to happen, but it was still tough at the time. We had 5 hours with Willow before she grew her wings and left. So, it was amazing 5 hours.
Was that your is that your youngest? So I'm just, had another.
Yeah, then we had another one.
Because I'm just curious as well, like how does that then impact? I mean, you've sort of said, obviously, you're just very guarded, like, you know, step by step, let's sort of, you know, take it as it comes.
Mm.
Do you feel a level of sort of nerves during the pregnancy at the moment? Like, how do you feel? Are you sort of optimistic?
A bit of everything. I'm actually quite excited. But like I said before, like, just kind of is a lot way from being told you're pregnant to birth. So, I'll go into the scans. Just hoping everything's going to be fine, tick every box, and then, hopefully, well, so far so good. Everything's going well and it's going really good. So hopefully it'll go a smooth sailing all the way.
Yeah. And, Maddie, you sort of mentioned that the pregnancy at the start wasn't the easiest. Talk us through what happened for you.
I think I was about 5 weeks. I started to get really quite ill.
Mm.
So we just obviously found out about 4 weeks. And then I probably had a 1 week of joy and peace before, hyperemesis kicked in. Mm. So that was really tough. I was really quite unwell. I didn't get formally told or diagnosed, I guess, with hyperemesis until about 10 weeks. I think it was 9 or 10 weeks. And thankfully, when I hit about the 16-week mark, I started to come out of that really deep sort of hyperemesis and could – 16 weeks was the first week that I worked full-time again. Mm. So from about 5 weeks to 16, I couldn't get through a normal week of work, which was really tough for me because I'm a bit of a workaholic. I didn't necessarily have a lot of vomiting, but I just had 24-hour nausea. It was like the worst hangover you could imagine that just never went away. Mm. And on top of that, I had really low blood pressure, which was causing me to have these episodes of, I guess, collapsing in a way. So, I mean, I needed Gary to help walk me down the hallway just to get to the bathroom because I couldn't sort of get up and be on my own 2 feet. I couldn't drive. I couldn't leave the house because I was just so unwell. I couldn't have a shower and stand up long enough to have a shower. You know, I was getting Gary to help me wash my hair and things like that. So it was awful. It was a really tough time.
Well, I can say it's lucky I have short hair because washing your hair all the time like that, I don't know how you do it.
Gives you a bit of an idea of what we go through. Yeah,
no, I'll give you credit for that.
It was a whole new world for him. Wow.
Briefly interrupting this episode to tell you a bit about our episode sponsor, Baby Bee. Australian-owned and designed prams combining quality, safety and style. What makes Baby Bee different is that they operate exclusively online, and this enables them to provide top quality products at an accessible price point. They let you try their prams at home with free returns for up to 9 months, and you also get an industry-leading 3-year warranty for total peace of mind. With thousands of 5-star reviews, around-the-clock customer care, and up to $200 of free accessories with every pram, what are you waiting for? Visit Baby Bee online and check them out for yourselves. I'll pop the details in the episode notes.
So you mentioned as well that you'd sort of started seeing symptoms of that in the first pregnancy that didn't eventuate. So yeah. Your body's clearly a little bit more susceptible to these things.
Like, I'm assuming, yeah. I mean, you can hear stories of hyperemesis that some women have it in every pregnancy. Mm. Some women have it their whole pregnancy, you know, the whole 40 weeks. Mm. And then some women you might have it once and not again, or they might have it. We've got a friend, Emma, who she was really sick when she had her 2 girls, but her boy pregnancy, she wasn't as sick. Mm. So I don't think it's really got a rhyme or reason. Yeah. It's just one of those things that, you're either more susceptible or, if there's other lifestyle things that might contribute, I'm not 100% sure, but, with the first pregnancy, I definitely didn't have, the full kit and caboodle of the hyperemesis symptoms that I did with this pregnancy. Mm. And I guess looking back on that, I can sort of see now that possibly that was an indicator that our first pregnancy wasn't going to plan, or it may have just been a pregnancy that I was a bit more lucky with symptoms. Mm. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I definitely still had, you know, a bit of the nausea, definitely had the fatigue in the first pregnancy, but comparing our 7-week marks, I guess, and when we went for the first dating scan with the first pregnancy and the dating scan with this one, they were completely different. I was much more unwell this time around.
Yeah. Was there much of a gap between the pregnancies? I forgot to ask sort of how long did it take you to then conceive again?
Yeah, we fell pregnant the first time in December last year, so we just got married. Yeah. And then this time around, I think it was, you know, June or July.
Okay.
I think it was July. I can't do my maths off the top of my head. I think it was July. So, there was probably a good, 6 or 7 months in there, which it was a big contributor was obviously my body had to heal and take a bit of time after we'd lost the first pregnancy.
Yeah.
So they do sort of advise for you to not try again for a few months after your body regulates. Mm. So, after I'd had the surgery, there was quite a bit of time where my body was just out of sync and out of whack, and it just needed that time to A, heal, but also just get back in sync and regulate again before we could think about trying. But I was also probably really mindful about trying again because I didn't want to try too soon, and I wanted everything to be perfect so that we didn't, have to go through that again. Mm. With the miscarriage, they can't tell you why it happens. Yeah. They don't tell you to change anything. They don't say, why it happens. Mm. So, it's hard to sort of think about trying again and walking on eggshells, I guess, because you don't want to take a step wrong and you want to make sure everything's going to be okay. Mm. So I was really mindful of trying too soon and trying to be aware of where my body was at and how ready my body was, which was really hard to understand and estimate, I guess. I always sort of say that, this whole sort of obstetrics and maternity land is like speaking another language. Mm. Like it's my body and I'm living it, but I still felt really foreign and didn't really know how to read the play, I guess. Yeah. And I actually reached out to my gynecologist, who's also an obstetrician, and just wanted to hold her hand and just like help me along the way. I just didn't want to put a foot wrong and put us through something, like the miscarriage again. So she was actually amazing helping us through all of that and just, you know, reassuring us that it will be fine. And
it's such a pressure sometimes, I feel, and I just hear the language you're using, like, you know, I wanted it to be perfect. I didn't want to put a step wrong. Like, even though the medical professionals say there's no, like, rhyme or reason, I think particularly I notice it a lot speaking to, I mean, I've done over 100 episodes of this podcast. Yeah, I've spoken to a lot of parents. A lot from, on average, the birth mother feeling a level of accountability or like responsibility that it has to, you know, and if something doesn't pan out, then oh my goodness, did I put a step wrong? Yep. But like, it's like, why do we do, like, it's so frustrating because we shouldn't do it.
100%.
It's like, that's where you go, right? You go, I want to make it perfect next
it's
time.
It's on me. And I mean, especially, it's not as though I blamed myself or blamed us or anything we did for the miscarriage. I mean, all of the professionals said there was nothing that we could have done and there's no reason. It just is what it is and it happened. So it's not as though I necessarily blamed myself or blamed us for that at all. But the second time around, I guess you're a lot more mindful that there is this advice out there, you know, wait 2 or 3 normal periods before you try again and all of that kind of thing. But, you know, we really wanted a family and it's something that we wanted to try as soon as possible, but you're so mindful of what could, I guess, potentially go wrong. So I know I'd love to know why we do that. And I mean, I did say that if something happened again, I probably would have blamed myself a little bit more than I did the first time around. I probably would have thought, you know, we should have waited longer or we should have done this or X, Y, Z. But, thanking our lucky stars that everything went okay.
Yeah. And how was that? So going back to being quite ill, I'm just wondering, Gaz, from your perspective, I mean, were you around firstly, because your job's quite demanding, were you around to be able to support and what did that look like?
It was the back end of the season, so it was a little bit, but it was tough. I felt so helpless. I couldn't do anything. Mads was like, wasn't crook, but she felt crook all the time. You can just see how like fatigued she was. I had to help her, like she said, shower and do stuff. And, I seriously didn't know what to do. I could help. I was just making sure I was around and had everything there that she needed to help her as much as I can. It's like I couldn't take the sickness away or anything like that. So, it was pretty hard just to sit there and look at someone you loved go through all this. So it was probably quite tough.
Absolutely. So I'm wondering for those listening, you know, and what are some things that, I mean, both of you found supportive? Like, you know, Maddie, was there something that, you know, Gaz did that you're like, that really helped me? Maybe things to be mindful of for others who might be sitting in this situation at the moment?
I just needed him around, I think. And, you know, it's tough when, as you said, he's obviously got a very demanding job. So, a part of my symptoms being that, you know, I had these little collapsy episodes and I didn't feel safe driving. I was on a lot of medication as well. So it wasn't safe for me to leave the house. You know, Gaz, and he does it anyway, but he had to make sure that he was the one doing the supermarket runs. Like, there was one day where I just wanted to get out of the house and I just asked him to take me to the supermarket just so that I could, like, get out of the house. I think the isolation was probably the hardest thing for me. So having that company, you know, because I couldn't necessarily go out and go to someone's house or go and do something to sort of alleviate that feeling of isolation. I just needed him home with me. You know, the washing can wait, the dishwasher can wait, all of that kind of thing just wasn't important. I just needed him with me and, to help me walk down the hallway, as I said, or help me, you know, with all of those just basic activities of daily living that you get taken away from you so easy. Yeah, it was just the company. It was just, what do they say? Misery loves company.
Yeah, like right. I remember even you're talking about when we feel our most vulnerable, that's when we need our partners the most. I remember when I was giving birth in the hospital the first time, and the first time you're just like, I didn't even know what's just happened. And at one point I had Jules, my husband, it was a bit of a story because he didn't know we were driving. He's like, do you know it's the middle of the night? Hey, Lee, do you know where the entrance to the hospital is? Do you think that's at the back? Meanwhile, at the back of the car being like, just take
me. We had a similar thing. I went into ED one day and he drove. You've got to drive past one of the hospitals to get to the hospital we're going through.
Yeah.
And Gary literally almost pulled up at the wrong hospital. Was like, do you want to go in here and I'll go get a park? I'm like, this is the wrong hospital. I don't want to go here at all.
Tip for those listening, know the entrance to the hospital and the after hours entrance.
Yes. Because
it was 1 a.m, just like, and he had this calm voice and I wanted to murder you. Yeah. Like, the entrance
so
on this side.
Or
the,
so
and I'm literally like, but anyway, so we get in there though. He's driving me nuts. He finally parks the car. He comes in the room. And then from then on, I'm like, I cannot have anyone. Like, you cannot go anywhere. Like,
leave.
Literally, at one point, they were like, Jules, would you like to go downstairs and get yourself a coffee? We're going to be here for a bit. I'm like, don't leave me, because you are. When you're vulnerable and you're feeling, death and all of the things, you just want
the person
that you care for the most to be around.
Yeah. And we hadn't, I suppose, told a whole lot of people either. So, we've got so many amazing friends and family around us, but it was something that, because we were treading a little bit more lightly this time with, that we'd had the miscarriage and we weren't sort of wanting to tell a whole lot of people, just because we didn't know how to word things if anything were to go wrong again, I guess. So I had the support I could have reached out for, but, there's a lot of that sort of taboo-esque around your pregnancy and when you announce it and when you start telling people. So it was hard for me to reach out to some people that I probably normally would have that are close by. And, yeah, like you said, I just wanted him at the end of the day. Like, I just wanted to lay in his arms and complain or whatever it needed to be. So
absolutely. And I'm just curious. I mean, obviously, Gaz, you've got a decent profile. As soon as you announce that you guys are pregnant, the world knows, right? I mean, it's not just old me with my little kid. Right. So, I mean, was that also the element of hesitation? Because the last thing you wanted to do was tell the world, and then how soon do you tell? Like, what was that journey like with the announcement?
Yeah, something we both talked a lot about.
Yeah, we did. And I think even early days, the first appointment I went to, I told Gaz not to come because I was like, if people see us in this obstetrician's rooms, that could just get taken out of context way too easily, especially in Geelong. Geelong's a very small little town.
Yeah,
sure is.
It was something that we spoke about a lot, because we probably wouldn't have necessarily announced it on social media if we didn't have that profile to sort of need to keep up with, I guess. We have a lot of friends that, they are struggling to have babies and they're struggling to conceive, and we're really mindful of that. As well as wanting to have a little bit of privacy in those times where, we're struggling or, it was a really big decision for us. And in a way, I think we had to be mindful as well, because there's only so long that you can hide a pregnancy for, and we wanted it to be told in our narrative. We didn't want that to be taken out of context or for it to be told before we could tell it, I guess, was always probably our risk being Gary has that sort of higher profile. When we did announce it to social media, we tried to announce it in a way that was going to be mindful of those that were struggling or that would find it triggering. Because I think when we went through the miscarriage, it was actually one of the ladies in the sort of health system that said to me, everyone will be pregnant now. She goes, now that you've had a loss, you will just think the whole world is pregnant and falling pregnant around you.
And exactly what happened.
It is.
All our friends just started getting pregnant and
So that was really tough. And so, yeah, the way that we put it on social media, we tried to acknowledge that we're pregnant, but we want all of those around us that might see this and feel triggered to know that we're thinking of you and that, yeah, we're there to support anybody going through the same. Because, yeah, I guess we were quite triggered when we were seeing those ourselves after just having the miscarriage. So it was tough. It's really tough to be compassionate in those times while you've got, you know, this amazing news that you do want to shout from the rooftop. Just being really considerate and mindful of those people around you, you know.
Did you, Gaz, feel as though you wanted to sort of tell even work and people in the team, you know, before you did the massive announcement to the world? What did that look like for you?
Yeah, I told pretty much everyone at the club at the time.
So
I started with a couple of close teammates and then went around and then, told the coaches and by then, I was just hoping everything was going to be okay. But in the end, I was just like telling everyone, like, oh, hang on, I got to make sure I'm not telling everyone because it's a bit soon yet. But
how many weeks do you reckon when most people knew from your world?
Well, I started people at the club probably found out when we were maybe 9, 10 weeks.
Okay. Yeah.
It was also, there was one weekend, Gary was injured and wasn't actually playing, but he was expected to go to the game. It was a Melbourne game, but I ended up in emergency that weekend with the hyperemesis. So he had to sort of tell a few of the coaches and things at the time, like, look, Mads is actually in hospital. I can't come to the game tonight. So that was probably the first point where you actually started telling people because we didn't really have a choice.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
And how have you found, I mean, I'm just curious, Gaz, obviously you've, you know, been, had kids, you've got children and had the job, the very demanding job as well. I'm just wondering, how do you juggle it? Because it's not that easy if you're traveling and things like that. And then do you just ensure, I guess, Maddie, that from your perspective, you've got enough of a tribe to reach out to in the times in which you're away? Like, I was just wondering, because it's a pretty full-on role. And also for those listening, you know, I know for myself, Jules travels at least once a week for work, right? It was really tough for me in the early days and I had to lean on a lot of family and support. So what did that look like for you? And then what are you guys thinking as the best structures to put in place?
So it is pretty tough leaving kids in that home. We've got friends that live 100 metres down the road, so they're always going to help out. We always say our families are both like 2 hours away, so they're close enough for a phone call to come, but far enough they're not always on your doorstep. little things like that. I've just got we have a good support, like you said, around us. So when I go play interstate, it's usually only a night or two. I have that people for there. And if I really need to come back, there's always a flight that's going to, I can come on. Excuse me. The Geelong Footy Club are really good. They're a family-based team first. So, like, if I'm not up to it, not feeling up to it, something's going on at home, they're like, it's fine. Family comes first and then it's football. So, they're really understanding. So, having that in the back of my mind also is positive.
They're an amazing club and, you know, they'd also happily facilitate or help in any way they can, you know, if that's getting me on a flight with Bob or something so that we can come over to Perth and, you know, if Gary's playing over there or, we're never too afraid to ask the club for help or to tell them what's going on if we're going through something that might be tricky. So I think that's, as Gaz said, that's really reassuring to know is that if anything is ever too tough, they're going to be more than welcoming and happy to help. I think the only other thing is just when Gaz has a full-on schedule, it's also probably harder on him as well, knowing that, you know, he's got to leave and he's got to miss out on little things or time away. But, I mean, it's also probably a good thing to have somewhere for him to go and clear his head for a couple of hours a day and kick a footy around and run around with his mates and come home and be that, that refreshed positive vibe to swoop in and help me if I've had a tough day or something like that. So, you know, he's like that anyway, day-to-day life without kids. So I'm sure he'll be the exact same, maybe just a little bit more tired.
Yeah, that sleep deprivation gets you good.
So excited.
Oh, no, guys, it was so lovely speaking to you both. I honestly wish you all the best for the rest of your pregnancy. And I also just want to honour how open and honest you have been, because, you know, these are some challenging sort of experiences that both of you have had. And, yeah, I have no doubt you're going to be amazing parents. So we'll have to have you back on once Bubs is not too fresh.
Yeah.
We can get phase two. But yeah, thanks both of you for your time.
No worries.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe, leave us a rating or review, and share it with your friends. Want to contribute to the conversation? Hit us up on Instagram at ParenthoodPod and join our Facebook group. Until next time.
Thanks for listening.
The Parenthood Podcast would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we produce on, the land of the Wurundjeri people. We pay respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging.